Good morning and welcome to another edition of InvestorIdeas.com podcast. Conversations with CEOs of stocks to watch, thought leaders talking about the economy, the stock market, and industry trends to follow. Today I'm talking to Stephen Johnson, a private equity manager and director of Omnigence, about Canada's weakening GDP, inflation, what Canada needs to do to invite capital investment back into the country, and how anyone can invest in this environment by looking at some basic economic principles. Well, thank you for joining us today, Stephen. For our listeners that don't know who you are and your background, can you talk about your experience at your private equity firm, Omnigence, and what you're looking at right now in the market?
I have been a private equity investor for 30-plus years now. The earlier part of my career was spent in the UK, investing into the former Soviet Union. And then in the early 2000s, I came back to Canada and started the first area of focus was being farmlands. And then in the last 10 years, my partners and I have started to make material investments into the Canadian small business space from the private equity perspective.
And looking at small business, is there any particular sectors that you're looking at or that you're favoring right now?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, so we our fund is focused on four verticals. So it's master franchises, Smitty's and Carroll Baker Visage, and Master Mechanic, which is a big chain of automotive repair locations in Ontario. Environmental services, all the things that go around net zero compliance and destructive and non-destructive testing of buildings and infrastructure. We have investments in the building products distribution space. Obviously, Canada is facing a very large backlog of required housing, and so it's a very rapidly growing part of the economy. And so those are our core focuses. And then over time, as we, as we sell off a holding, we, find another area of the economy we like, find a platform acquisition, and start to buy companies to integrate in.
So looking at Canada's economy right now, and you look at some of the headlines, it's pretty scary. You see headlines like Canada's GDP per capita in Q1 fell for the seventh straight quarter. You see headlines that say Canada's standard of living is on track for the worst decline in 40 years. Can you talk about the difference of what the average consumer hears in terms of inflation and the impact on them and Canada's GDP per capita and what the real threats are? And I think that's one of the areas you really wanted to talk about with us.
I do and I don't, I suppose. It's I think it's necessary to talk about it, but it's a bit depressing to talk about. And so, the challenge for Canada is that although we have, moderately good growth on an aggregate basis, the economy is growing 1 or 2% a year. And that's in nominal terms. The challenge is after you account for population growth and inflation, the real GDP growth, meaning the inflation-adjusted growth per person, that's actually declining. And so, the disconnect that most people, might feel when they read the news is, oh, people are saying the economy is growing. And yet I feel like, my share of the economy is shrinking. Well, that actually is the case. Once you adjust for, population growth and inflation, the average person is experiencing a decline in their standard of living. And that's been going on for 10 years, 10 years plus. And most people feel frustrated about is that there's people, in the public eye who deny that that's the case. And it's like, listen, I don't need you to tell me things are good. I know what I experience when I go to the grocery store and I see my wages and I see the cost of living and, no one can tell me that the economy is in good shape. And the challenge for Canada is that it's not a trivial problem to fix, because the reason we're in this situation, it's not just one or two things that we've done, particularly badly. It's a list of things that we've been doing badly for decades. And so it's going to be a very difficult challenge to address going forward.
Don't you think things that like COVID really expanded that threat even more so when you look at a lot of people. That's probably for some people, the small businesses haven't recovered yet. They were still in recovery, and then inflation came along and their interest rates went up. A lot of people, this is one of the other questions that I wanted to ask you. A lot of younger people walked away from traditional economy because they found out they could do so much online. And when we look at GDP, how much are they factoring in some of these obscure online jobs where people are making money, but maybe it's not really being found in the same way? I think there is an underground economy that we don't really talk about or track.
I mean, there's invariably an underground economy, but typically GDP statistics are not, they're not too bad because they go on tax. You know, there's an element of tax receipts and, you know, all the information that's filed with the government. But yeah, there's a component of people who are, you know, there's new areas of the economy. But in order for that not to be swept up into GDP reporting, it means people aren't declaring their income, right? So I don't know if they're doing that or not. But I mean, stepping aside from that just for one moment, I mean, the issue for Canada is that we have like the highest debt levels in Canadian history. And we run a current account deficit, meaning we consume more than we produce. Like, we import goods from other countries. We have a fiscal deficit, meaning the government spends more than it takes in revenues. We have capital outflows, meaning, you know, even Canadian investors and pension plans and individual investors take their capital and move it out of the country and invest in other markets because they don't see that the returns are going to be good in Canada. We have – sorry, I'm just going through the list because I think we should get through the list – we have very poor capital formation in Canada. And we have very low capital formation. Like, we don't invest in productive capital. We tend to consume. And even the capital formation we have is disproportionately residential real estate. And I would argue the residential real estate isn't really productive capital. It's just a consumption good. Everybody needs to live in a house, right? And so our economy has very little investment in productive capital. And even that limited investment is overwhelmingly skewed to residential real estate. And, of course, residential real estate is at all-time record highs. We buy that residential real estate at the all-time highs using record amounts of leverage. That's not a good thing. Like, an economy can't flourish based on building residential real estate. You have to do other things. We have very unfavorable regulatory regime. Like, the regulatory regime in Canada worldwide is recognized as being very unreceptive to building infrastructure and making investments in productive capital. And so we tend to drive foreign capital away. And that leads to the problem is that we have very low labor productivity. And that's not to say that, you know, people don't have work ethic. It's to say that we don't invest enough to make labor more productive. So the only way for all of our incomes to increase and our standard of living to go up is for labor productivity to increase. And Canada has a terrible track record in labor productivity because we don't invest in productive capital. And so those are all of our problems. And, you know, we need to start addressing them, and it's going to could take decades to fix. But until we start to have a public discussion that those are the problems and then what are the solutions, Canada's standard of living, unfortunately, is going to continue to decline. Like, if you inhibit the formation of capital and if you inhibit the investment into productive activities, you know, infrastructure, manufacturing, all of those things, right? You will inhibit people's standard of living, and we're seeing that exact thing play out in the Canadian economy. Like, we're the poster child for doing all those things wrong. And so the reason why the OECD says Canada is going to have the lowest real GDP per capita growth of all the OECD for the next 30 years is because of all these issues. And of course, what they're saying implicitly is they don't expect that Canada will fix those problems.
Looking at a lot of the comments that are out there just from the average people and some in business as well, a lot of, I think, what's happened is, you know, in the last so many years is also policies that have scared away investment, that we've had a lot of people leave Canada, a lot of very smart people leave Canada. And I think policies like the new capital gains tax, the immigration policies, just the spending that seems to be out of control from government. I think it scares everybody from a person working at 7-Eleven to, you know, a CEO. I think it scares everybody. based on what people are talking about. So if you think if the next election, if there's a change and we end up with a conservative government, how big a task and is it possible for a new government to change the world's perception of this country and to put things more in balance again?
Any problem can be fixed. So, like, I don't think that these problems are insoluble. The challenge is the political parties operate on a 4 to 5 year timeline. They're always working to the next election. And when problems may require 10, 15, 20 years to fix, what you need is a consistent philosophy and a consistent approach and a long-term, like long-term thinking. And I don't know that the political environment in Canada lends itself to long-term thinking. I think that this, all the thinking revolves around how to get reelected in 4 years. And that short-termism is what we're suffering from. I'll give you an example. The capital gains is just is the perfect encapsulation of this issue. So Canada needs more capital. Like, it needs more investment into productive capital, into productive activities, right? We need to increase the pool of capital in the country, and we need to attract capital from outside the country in order to solve a lot of our growth issues. And so if you talk to a politician, they would agree that if you tax alcohol, you get less production of alcohol, if people stop drinking. They believe that if you tax cigarettes, you get less production of cigarettes, if people smoke less. They believe that if you tax carbon, you get less production of carbon. But then they will not apply the same reasoning to capital. The logic must follow that if you increase the tax on capital, just like cigarettes, alcohol, and carbon, you're going to get less capital. And what Canada cannot afford now is less capital. We need more capital, not less. And this increase in the capital gains tax is just an example, I think, of this short-sightedness. I think it's a political gambit, in order to get reelected. When in practice, it's actually striking at the fundamental issue of the Canadian economy. We know that when you tax something, you get less of it. And to tax capital is exactly the opposite of what we should be doing. We need to encourage capital. We need to encourage capital from other countries to come here. And so we need to improve the regulatory environment in Canada. And people need to know that their capital is safe and that they're not going to be subject to, you know, regulatory impediments, and they're not going to be subject to unexpected increases in capital gains, because that affects their return profile. And so, sadly, I think that all the things that we've been doing in the last, decade and in the last 5 years are honestly – and ignoring the political party doing it, because, if you look back 30 years, every political party is engaged in these sort of activities, but no one's addressing the fundamental issues. And in fact, they're actively taking steps to make them worse. Like, I think that we are on track for a declining standard of living for a very extended period of time, until such time as it becomes so transparent and so obvious such an emergency that there'll be consensus in the voting population to say we have to take the steps to fix it. Because I think currently we don't have consensus. And I think that we need to discuss, the debt levels and the current account deficit and the government spending, the fiscal deficit and capital flows and capital formation, regulatory policy and labor productivity. And we need to recognize and have a true, objective, and informed discussion about what will improve those things, and then reach a consensus that that as Canadians, we have the will to take the 10 years or 15 years or even 20 years it might take to fix them and get us back onto the trajectory of an increasing standard of living, if an increasing standard of living is what we want. Like, I would assume it's a given, but it may not be. I don't know.
I think it's a given that the average Canadian citizen would like that. I think a lot of people feel that it's not a given that the government is encouraging that or putting in policy that puts a platform forward to do that or enable that. One of the things I wanted to talk about, I don't know if you have expertise or insight, but I get very frustrated, and I think a lot of people get very frustrated when the Bank of Canada comes out with their language and their discussions. And, with their recent rate cuts, they say that inflation has fallen in line with, what they were looking for. But I know for me personally, as a small business owner, Every single vendor that I have has increased their rates, whether it's my website hosting, the email companies that I use to send out. I have not had one single thing go down in cost in my life other than gas comes down a little bit.
They say inflation is falling. Yeah, that means the prices are going up less quickly, but they're still going up. I mean, we don't have negative inflation. We still have positive inflation. We've gone through this massive spurt of inflation, you know, and to a certain extent, we have a base, you know, issue. When prices go up a lot, you know, the subsequent increases seem smaller. But prices are still going up. And I think the idea that the Bank of Canada is cutting rates and that's a positive signal, that's the Bank of Canada saying they think the economy is extremely weak. And we still have, you know, 2 or 3% inflation. Like, I think that the published inflation rates tend to grossly underestimate inflation. I mean, I think that's something that every person who buys things would tell you that they feel intuitively. But, you know, CPI isn't a true indicator of inflation. It underreports inflation. But inflation is still going up. I mean, prices are still going up. And I think what we're going to find, it'll be like the 1970s. There was an initial bout of inflation. There was a rapid increase in central bank interest rate policies. Inflation started to come off. The economy started to weaken very rapidly. There was a rapid rate cutting cycle. And then inflation was relatively, you know, low for – prices were still going up, and inflation was low for about 2 or 3 years. Then there was a massive, massive increase in inflation that lasted 5 years and was very hard to get rid of. And I think we're seeing it. Your anecdote is what is happening. It's the initial burst of inflation. Some prices take much longer to catch up. Some people can't raise their prices immediately, or they, you know, it takes time for them to catch up with the initial burst of inflation. And so I think you're going to see inflation reignite. I mean, I think that the 1970s are a very good analog for what's going to happen today. We've had the initial bout of inflation. The economy has weakened considerably, but a lot of prices are still catching up, and, you know, to your point about suppliers. And then that process, combined with the government still running massive fiscal deficits, which are ultimately very inflationary, it's the expansion of the money supply that causes inflation, and it's government fiscal deficits which drive the expansion of the money supply. Well, they're still doing it. So we're going to see another very large run-up in inflation rates. But prices are, you know, 30, 40% higher than where they were 4 years ago. And that's a permanently higher level. Like, they're not going down. We're not experiencing negative inflation.
But I think, as you said, though, the way they skew data, the way they present data, the way the language that comes out, none of it feels, an intuition standpoint or gut instinct, that any of this is correct. And I guess I think a lot of people's fear is, so we're seeing the Bank of Canada lower rates, but how long and how much more do they have to go? Because typically they raise rates too late, and typically they lower rates too late. They're always behind the curve, because they say, what doesn't it take, like 18 months for something to really filter through? And they went on that rapid, rapid path of raising rates, raising rates, raising rates every single meeting. And now, are we going to just see them do that in the opposite direction because they really don't know what's happening in the economy?
Well, they do. I mean, I think it's a much more cynical decision than you think. Here's Canada's fundamental issue, is that the Canadian economy is massively indebted. On a growth basis, ignoring politicians who say net debt, that's nonsense. Like, PPP isn't available to pay off our debts. So it's gross debt that matters. So, like, the gross debt as a multiple of GDP is one of the highest in the world. Only Japan is higher. We have this massively over-indebted economy, including a massively over-indebted federal government. And so the federal, structurally, at high interest rates, effectively, as a country, Canada is broke. Like, the federal government can't afford the interest rates should be much higher structurally, right? With that level of debt in the economy, you would expect interest rates, if they were being manipulated, would be much higher, because people would be reluctant to lend to people with that level of debt. The Bank of Canada keeps rates suppressed, but they have to, because if rates were, you know, they were artificially adjusting rates and they were at their equilibrium level, the government of Canada would be bankrupt. They would be basically paying more out in interest than they'd be collecting in taxes. That's the definition of bankrupt. And so structurally, that's what Canada faces, is structurally, the Bank of Canada has an incentive to keep interest rates much lower than they should be, because otherwise Canada, particularly the Canadian governments, federal, provincial, municipal, can't service their debts. But of course, that's going to drive up inflation. There's no free lunch. If you suppress interest rates, you create inflation, which is just another tax. By allowing inflation to run much higher than it should, it's going to allow governments to delever effectively. They inflate away the values of their debt. This is why our thesis is always Canada is going to be structurally in stagflation for decades, because we have all this debt. It can't be repaid. It has to be inflated away. And we structurally have poor growth prospects. So we're going to have above-trend inflation, below-trend growth, which means on a real per capita basis, Canada is going to have stagnant or declining standards of living. I just don't see any way around it. I think that politically and as an organization, the Bank of Canada has a lot of pressure on it to keep rates low. But they know that it's going to drive inflation. But if they don't, I don't see how the Canadian government I don't see how it continues to be solvent, because it's borrowed more than it can repay. How does Canada, say the average person in Canada, I think GDP, the debt per person is what? I'm going to say it's $100,000 per person. How does that ever get repaid? The federal government has borrowed $100,000 for every person in Canada. Let's say that's roughly the number. How does that ever get repaid? De jure to pay, meaning, they pay down the principal. Of course, it never can be repaid. The only way to repay it is to inflate it away or default. And so, of course, they don't have to default if they can inflate it away. So I think what the average person in Canada and the average Canadian investor should expect is a low-growth, high-inflation economy for a very long time. Those are the incentives built into the system. The Bank of Canada will bail out the federal government's solvency by keeping rates below where they should be, allowing inflation to run high, to inflate away the value of the debt. And structurally, that will create problems for our growth prospect. We have high debt levels. It'll allow them to continue. I don't know. I'm sorry. It sounds gloomy, but sometimes you build up such a collection of issues that it takes a very long time and a lot of determination to fix them. And Canada is one of those countries. We have done the worst thing possible. We have borrowed an enormous amount of money, and we borrowed that money to consume, right? We run a current account deficit, meaning we import goods from other countries. And the federal government has run massive deficits. They've increased $1 trillion in the last 5 years. And all of that money went to consumption. It wasn't invested in production and infrastructure and factories and plants and equipment and technology. It was spent on current consumption. And so when you borrow to consume, you basically are pulling in growth from the future, right? Because you're borrowing and you're consuming, and eventually you can't borrow anymore, and so there's no growth anymore. And that's what we've done. We've done the worst thing possible. We borrowed to consume. And the reason we're in such structurally bad condition as far as growth is it would be one thing if we'd have borrowed all this money and we'd invested it, but we didn't. We consumed. And I can assure you that, we all know that at a personal level. If you take your credit cards and you spend beyond your income and you spend it on going out to restaurants, right, and you borrow to, buy a motorcycle and to go out to restaurants and on clothes, your standard of living is going to go down. You may even go broke. Well, that same reasoning applies to countries, and it applies to Canada and space. Like I said, we have one of the highest debt levels in the world. We run a very large current account deficit, meaning we consume more than we produce. Sorry, I'm repeating it, but it needs to be repeated. The government runs deficits, meaning it borrows money to operate. Our capital flows out of the country. It doesn't invest in Canadian productive assets. We have poor capital formation. We massively overinvest in residential real estate, which is not a productive asset. We have poor regulatory policy. It discourages foreign investment. We have low labor productivity. It couldn't get any worse. It needs to be fixed. If it doesn't get fixed, the Canadian standard of living is going to continue to go down, because inflation will be high and growth will be low.
One of the other topics you get such conflicting information from, the narrative. I guess people use whatever narrative they want to meet their agenda, but immigration is a very hot topic in terms of how the government portrays it, and they finally say they're going to crack down on it. But then there's the factor of illegal immigration and the amount of money that Canadian taxpayers are paying out to illegal immigrants. You see a senior citizen getting a base payment of $718 a month, and some of these illegal immigrants are getting up to $70,000 a year in benefits. But they always posture that immigration is good for the economy. Can you break it down a little bit for people? Because I don't think the average consumer right now or the average Canadian that can't pay their own bills is very happy about the track that this government has taken on immigration.
Well, I would say that let's just take the theory and then the practice. I think we have a theory and practice problem in Canada. I think in theory, the immigration of highly educated people with capital into your country creates growth. I believe that, right? Right? I mean, you know, people with skills and who bring capital don't consume social services. That's the theory. And so politicians always do they do the change, right? Because we all accept the theory. And so now they extrapolate and they say, therefore, any immigration is therefore good. But that's not the theory. The theory is what we said, highly educated people coming to this country with capital. That will contribute to growth. But they take that theory and they deliberately and intentionally misapply it. And now they say, we all agree that immigration causes growth, so what are you complaining about? But we agreed that a specific type of immigration would create growth. So what we have in Canada and the United States and, you know, and a lot of the EU and the UK is that we've taken that principle and we've distorted it into something that we know will not create growth. It can't create growth. Maybe it creates growth in the long term. I don't know. But it certainly doesn't create growth in the medium term, the short to medium term. And Canada's challenge is in the short to medium term. All of our problems are in the medium term. We have a growth problem today. And so while immigration could help it, we've chosen to do immigration in a way that will clearly not help. Right? And that's a political question. I don't know why they do it. I don't see how it can be to their political benefits for the economy to stay. But they seem to have decided that it is. This is a political calculation. It's not an economic calculation. Because if it was an economic calculation, our immigration policy would be very different. I think it would be the immigration policy of 20 years ago, right? Was that if you had capital, you could immigrate. If you were highly skilled and those skills were in short supply, you could immigrate. And I think that we've sort of drifted away from that approach. And, I mean, I think part of the problem we have today, particularly with government deficits, is we've drifted away from that approach. But as I said, it gets back to what I said. I think the problems in Canada are going to have to get so bad we can finally get a consensus on all these points and have an objective discussion without people hurling insults at each other, right? It's not anti-immigration to say that the immigration policies we have today do not work. It's not racist. It's not anti-immigrant. It's not, you know, it's not nativism. It's just an honest assessment of how it's being done, right? And I think we need to have a discussion about all these things, about the government debt levels, government deficits, right? Capital flows, like the regulatory environment. Because we all know that, you know, the regulatory environment can impact people's appetite to invest in the country. And Canada is explicitly creating a regulatory environment that discourages investment in natural resources and infrastructure and factories and mines and all, explicitly doing that. That's our competitive advantage. The world needs those commodities. It needs those things. And so for a regulatory policy, not to accidentally discourage those things, but to explicitly discourage those things, is to basically say that we want the Canadian economy to contract because they know that it will. That's what it'll cause. And so it gets back to what I said a little bit earlier. You've got to step back and say, in some political circles, there may be they may be actively trying to create an economic contraction. Like the idea that, you know, the growth is bad and that we should stop growing and, in fact, even start to contract, like that's actually what they're seeking. And so when Canadian citizens, the average citizen goes, I don't understand. They're doing all these things that are so, you know, counterproductive and they don't make sense, right? Well, maybe they should start looking at it through the lens of there are political parties and political actors in the economy that would say it was a good thing if Canada's growth started to Canada stopped growing, and in fact, the Canadian economy shrank. And so then if you start to think, oh, well, if you start to look at it through that lens, and some of the actions that the political parties are taking might make more sense. Because it's not, these things aren't complicated. You want affluence? Capitalism creates affluence. And if you want affluence, you encourage the creation of capital. You encourage the investment into productive activity and productive assets. And we all know it's not complicated. That creates affluence. That creates a high standard of living for the most people. And the way to encourage the investment into productive capital is very simple, right? You reduce the taxes on it. You reduce income taxes. You reduce capital taxes. You increase taxes on consumption. You encourage people to invest. And that'll increase your standard of living. The idea that it's complicated is ridiculous. It's simple. Solve Canada's problems is complicated. We need a consensus politically, which we don't have. But, you know, I mean, like I said, like people are struggling to understand why Canada is having this, you know, stagflation problem, elevated inflation levels and poor growth. It's easy to understand. I mean, in fact, it's so easy to understand, that's why I suggest that it's perhaps intentional.
Well, there's no other real explanation for it, is there? It's just common sense seems to be gone, and it's an agenda that doesn't make sense to most people, though. One of the things I'd like to ask you is when you're talking about, you know, that you see slow growth for decades, and how does a private equity firm like yours navigate through that? And when you're making investments, how do you make your bets in that kind of an environment? That's a tough environment to play in and swim in.
Well, it is and it isn't. And I this is going to sound horribly rapacious and insensitive, but Canada has a structural growth problem and an inflation problem. And typically, like that set of like macroeconomic conditions tends to contract them, tends to reduce the size of the middle class, right? Inflation tends to increase the value of the assets of the, you know, top 5% of the population, right? And it tends to restrict the purchasing power of the middle class. And then, like, below-trend growth or even contraction tends to reduce the middle class and increase the lower-income class. It's called the socioeconomic barbell. And so Canada's like, has all the conditions for the socioeconomic barbell. And, in fact, in the last 15 years, you've seen the middle class consistently contract. And the number of low-income and high-income people increased. And so if I was an investor looking at Canada, I'd say, well, Canada's growth is really poor. It's not a great place to invest. Well, it can be a great place to invest if you invest in things that are driven by the demand from the top 10% income earners and the lowest 20% income earners. If your investment strategy, and this is why I said it sounds insensitive, benefits from the shrinking of the middle class, you can actually have growth rates that are much higher than the average growth rate in the economy and actually do really well. And so, for instance, we invest in auto maintenance. We have an auto maintenance platform. And as the middle class is pressured by inflation and low growth, they tend to own their cars much longer. And, of course, as you extend the life of your car, it needs more maintenance. And so in an economy like Canada's, you know, perversely, you see poor growth, but you actually see very strong growth rates in the maintenance sector. There's an example of how you can find something that benefits from this stagflationary environment. Here's another example. Canada, you know, has stagflation, you know, above trend inflation, below trend growth. But because of our immigration policy, we've created and our regulatory policies, we've created a shortfall of 3 million houses. And so there's this massive pressure to build out residential real estate. So we own what is building out to be one of the biggest building products distribution companies in Canada. Because even though Canadian growth might be bad, the growth in the building products distribution sector is very, very rapid because you have the shortfall of houses. So you can see how, even though in a generally poor economy, where an economy where the middle is shrinking and the ends, you know, the barbell is getting bigger, there are sectors of the economy where we're actually going to grow quite rapidly. It just sounds insensitive, and I wish this wasn't happening, but like I'm saying, there are parts of the economy, but because of the nature of how stagflation affects the middle class, that do actually grow quite rapidly. I wish they weren't. Honestly, I wish they weren't. But they are.
Can you give another example, another sector? Because what I'd like as a takeaway for our listeners, which a lot of them are small retail investors, is to take that same strategy and apply it to stocks that they would buy in the market. And, you know, a lot of people right now are betting on gold, they're betting on Bitcoin, but obviously there's a lot of other things that you can apply to what's happening out there and especially if you're taking more of a long-term approach. You're not going to look at this as happening in 6 months, but if you take an approach like that, so maintenance companies, like the home builders, the suppliers, what are some other ideas?
Probably automotive maintenance and supplies, parts manufacturers, right? Because obviously parts are a critical part of auto maintenance. It's a big part of the Canadian economy, the auto sector. Not the manufacturing of new cars, the manufacturing of the aftermarket parts suppliers, building products, obviously, environmental services. I mean, we've created a regulatory, I don't see Canada's commitment to net zero 2050 changing. There's a lot of environmental services businesses that are part of, you know, either destructive, non-destructive testing or, you know, testing compliance or helping set up these, you know, renewable energy facilities, those kind of businesses. I would suggest that, you know, I would look at it through a slightly different lens. Look at your investments and ask yourself, do my investments require robust middle-class demand in order to generate returns? And if the answer is yes, then you should start to reallocate and start to say, I need investments in sectors where the demand is not a strong middle class, because I think that the middle class has been under a lot of pressure in Canada for decades. And so we've gone through some examples like auto maintenance, building product, right? Environmental services is sort of independent of middle class demand growth. So you can find businesses and investments like that, you know, multi-tenant real estate. Perversely, in Canada, the assets are at all-time highs, but the demand is relentless. It's kind of a paradox. I'm a bit nervous about, you know, real estate investments in Canada. There is huge demand, but valuations are so high that it's hard to see how returns continue. Not to avoid your question, but I think a better investment lens or investment screen is to say, okay, I've got all these investments. And if I find any of them where middle-class demand is critical to that business, I should be asking myself if that's an investment I want to hold. So you've got all the sort of retail companies, you know, the clothes companies and, you know, appliance, like all those kind of things that cater to middle-class demand. They may see sluggish growth. They will see sluggish growth in the decades to come, at least in the decade to come, while these problems are being fixed. And then I would suggest, how do you insulate yourself from the inflationary piece? Like, for instance, we invest in farmland. We have an enormous, it's almost a $500 million farmland portfolio, because farmland hedges recessions really well and hedges inflation really well. Well, there's an example of something that is indifferent to middle-class demand. It's global demand. And people's food consumption is very inelastic. And so if there's a recession, it doesn't change the demand for food, and farmland hedges inflation. Gold is an inflationary hedge. I don't know that it generates real returns. You know what I mean? It preserves your purchasing power, but would you get a real return from it? I don't know. But for instance, I perhaps consider farmland, not because we invest in it, but I mean, we invest in it because we see these macro trends unfolding. So you need to think about things like that. What investments are like hedge recessions really well? And what investments hedge inflation really well? And what investments are not tied to middle class demand? And ask yourself those questions and find things that fit in those three buckets.
That's great advice. Like I say, I know the average person doesn't have access to the funds at a private equity firm, but it's the strategy that counts and it's the approach that counts.
Yeah, but I mean, there are lots of options out there. There are lots of ways to invest. I mean, there's all the publicly traded entities. There's all the ETFs. Mutual funds, and there's a lot of access to alternative investments and private equity funds. Like our funds are on the, you know, are distributed by a lot of the broker dealers, Canaccord, Wellington, Richardson, Raymond James. So, there are ways to access alternative strategies. Typically, alternative strategies tend to hedge inflation because they're real asset strategies. They hedge the inflation piece. Not all alternative strategies hedge recessions really well. Farmland's kind of unique in that respect. But like I said, it's always better than rather me saying, here's four things to invest in. I don't think that's helpful. I think it's better to arm people with the right set of questions, right? Does this hedge inflation? Does this hedge recessions? Does this depend on middle-class demand? Those are three great questions that every investor should be asking themselves.
In closing, in the next couple of meetings with Bank of Canada, most people are expecting, bigger cuts again. And do you think that if they do that, that there'll be any positive impact in the next year or two, or are you going to stick to the story that you think we've got decades of this?
Yeah, the challenge here is Canada has a structurally weak currency, right? Because we have poor growth, so our currency is weak. And so here's the challenge. And we run a current account deficit, meaning we import all these foreign goods. And so the pressure is on the Bank of Canada to cut rates. Like an economy with the level of debt we have can't sustain high rates. It's very, very challenging. So they're going to cut rates. So I don't know. Institutional pressure is enormous for them to cut rates. I don't know, the path they'll take, but I think the Canadian economy is going to weaken quite rapidly. And then here's the challenge. When they cut rates, the Canadian dollar is going to continue to get weaker. And because we buy all these foreign goods, that's going to drive up inflation instantly, right? When you have a massive current account deficit and you import all these foreign goods, when your currency weakens, the price of those goods goes up. And because you haven't invested in productive capital and manufacturing, there's no substitutes manufactured locally for these products. And so there is no, you can't stop buying them, medicine and technology and computers and all these things that we import. And so when they cut rates, it's going to weaken the Canadian dollar, and that's going to be one of the factors that drives up the next leg of inflation. It's going to be the weakening of the Canadian dollar. And I'm sorry, what we've created is a problem which is like a balloon. You push on one part of the balloon and it expands somewhere else. Until Canada gets serious and deals with the real problems, I mentioned that list, everything else it does is like a Band-Aid. Cutting rates, yeah, okay, it helps for a bit, and then it drives up inflation. Like really what we need to do is de-lever, reduce our debt, reduce our current account deficit, right? Start producing more than we consume, produce it domestically. We've got to rein in federal government spending. We've got to balance the federal budgets. We've got to balance the provincial budgets. We've got to balance the municipal budgets, right? We've got to encourage capital to flow into the country. And we've got to overhaul our regulatory environment, because we've got to be friendly to capital. Otherwise, we'll achieve, even if we do all the other things, if no capital will invest in the country, you still haven't achieved anything. And so cutting rates and, changing the marginal rate of tax and all these, and government programs and subsidies and small things here and there, they're just Band-Aids. We need to fix the big problems. Until we do, none of this stuff will have any long-lasting effect. The trend is still negative.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. InvestorIdeas.com is a go-to platform for big investing ideas. From breaking stock news to top-rated investing podcasts, we cover it all. Our original branded content includes podcasts such as Exploring Mining, Clean Tech, Crypto Corner, Cannabis News, and the AII. To learn more about our site, go to InvestorIdeas.com.
Our site does not make recommendations for purchases or sale of stocks, services, or products. Nothing on our site should be construed as an offer or solicitation to buy or sell products or securities. All investing involves risk and possible losses. Paid content is always disclosed. Global investors must adhere to regulations of each country. Please read the investorideas.com privacy policy on our website. Thanks and have a great day.